Okay, so Shri gave me instructions to talk about the electromagnetic signatures from coalescing white dwarfs. I cheated a little bit. I've smuggled in a little bit about rates and a little bit about what happens after the merger, because it's relevant for deciding what the electromagnetic signatures might be, and rates might be relevant for deciding whether you want to look for these or not. I was also going to say something about precursors, but that got condensed in the realities of 20 minutes. Okay, I thought I should start by explaining the relation of this talk to the next two. So I have a little cartoon history of binary stellar evolution here, starting with two main sequence stars. One becomes a red giant. Maybe this one spirals in or not. If it doesn't, you get a white dwarf in a main sequence star. This one swells up and starts feeding material to the white dwarf. And if it's unstable transfer, there's a common envelope. And if this star, as it spirals in, releases enough energy to unbind the envelope, then you're left with two white dwarfs. If it doesn't, then you listen to Ed's talk. If you end up with two white dwarfs, they're very small, so I magnified them here, about 10 or 20% of the time, there's a mass ratio large enough that this one begins to stably transfer mass onto the other one, and then you listen to Lars's talk. In the other 80 or 90% of the time, the white dwarfs get together and they merge, and then you listen to my talk. Okay.
That's right.
Shri was very unfair in this time division. I agree. Yeah, that's right. That's the bottom line. Okay. So first of all, the rates are fairly well determined, which in astronomy means a factor of three or something, both from theoretical understanding that we pretty much understand, we think, what happens to wide binary stars, and from observations. And the recent SPY survey, for example, has turned up seven double white dwarfs which will merge in less than a Hubble time, so we know they exist in the volume surveyed. And both the theory and the observation agree fairly well about the rates. So I should emphasize that these rates tell you the rates at which gravitational radiation will bring a pair of white dwarfs close enough that they're in contact transferring vital fluids to each other. The question of whether that's stable or unstable, and therefore leads to merger or to Lars's talk, is more subtle and involves things like tides in the white dwarfs, mass ejection from the white dwarf, transport of angular momentum by the disk and by the tides, which are much less certain. But it's also true that if you have very different beliefs on that, you can always find 50% of the stars that will be unstable in whichever scenario you like. So maybe that 10 or 20% I said for Lars is not quite right, but it's probably not very different than 50%. So at least half of these will probably merge, but maybe not necessarily the ones that I tell you in this conventional wisdom story. So first of all, starting with the Milky Way, the conventional wisdom for the merger rates in the Milky Way from single star evolution, I mean, of course, they're two stars. I mean, stars not in clusters, and there's a little paragraph here about clusters. So helium plus helium white dwarfs with a total mass peaking around 0.6 solar masses, the rate's about one every 150 years. Helium plus CO, the rate is about one every 50 years in the Milky Way, the total mass of a solar mass. And CO plus CO white dwarfs, the rate is again about one every 150 years. And about half of these have masses greater than 1.4 solar masses. And so that rate is about one every 300 years. And those are the ones which are either, depending on whether they go in or go out, type 1a supernova or accretion-induced collapse to neutron stars. The time delays, these white dwarfs initially are born by common envelope evolution. And in the conventional wisdom, they're comparable numbers of systems that are born with in-spiral times that are comparable to the age of the universe and much less than the age of the universe. And so you would expect the long delay ones to track old stars, and the short delay ones will track star formation. And so you'd expect a large variation of the rates of all of these with galaxy type compared to unit mass, but not necessarily with respect to current star formation. So these rates, I've listed here three papers. The first one proposing a lot of this was by Webbing in 1984. Most recent ones by Hahn and Nalemans are also papers by Eben and Tudikov and others, Caligari's group and so on. And they all agree on these rates, as I said, within a factor of two or so. as long as they use the same sort of input assumptions about binary fractions. One little footnote down here is that Shara and Hurley a few years ago did a simulation not of isolated binaries, but of binaries in star clusters. And they found that the exchanges of the massive stars and hardening of the binaries gave them 15 times more CO plus CO white dwarf mergers than the standard evolution. And since a large fraction of the stars in the galaxy are born in clusters, this is potentially a large enhancement to these rates. On the other hand, their clusters were a bit more generous than the typical open cluster, and so maybe it's not 15, but it's certainly something to keep in mind if you think this isn't enough type 1a rate or something. Okay, so we can now take those Milky Way rates and the population synthesis models that go into them and integrate over the star formation history of the universe to get the local redshift zero rate per unit volume. And those are listed here as typically something like 10 to the minus 4 per cubic megaparsec per year. And of course, that volume would suggest that you should look out to about 15 megaparsecs, but at 15 megaparsecs, the mean number of galaxies inside the volume is much larger than in a uniform universe because galaxies are clustered and we're unusually close to the Virgo cluster. And so actually, to see one of these events per year, you need to look out to about 7 or 10 megaparsecs. So Virgo is a good distance. You should see something like one of these per year, or a few of these per year at the distance of Virgo. Okay, the theory. So the standard simple-minded theory is very simple to understand. White dwarfs are degenerate polytropes, and so the less massive they are, the bigger they are. So if you start mass transferring from a fairly massive white dwarf, as it loses mass, it gets larger. But if it's comparable mass to its companion, its Roche lobe does not get larger very fast, or at least not fast enough, and so the star overfills its Roche lobe and you get dynamically unstable mass transfer. The star dumps all of its mass onto the companion in a few orbits. If the mass ratio is less than 0.6, as the star loses mass, it swells, but its Roche lobe also gets bigger. And so the mass transfer is dynamically stable. And this 0.6 is appropriate if the angular momentum that's transferred in the accretion onto the companion is put back into the orbit. And that means that as it loses mass, the orbit expands, which of course helps make the Roche lobe bigger. If you don't transfer the angular momentum back, then the orbit doesn't expand, and so you have to make sure that your white dwarf is swelling less rapidly, and so you need a mass ratio of less than about 0.2. to make it stable, even if there's no transfer of angular momentum back to the orbit. And that transfer of angular momentum back to the orbit in traditional studies of cataclysmic variables and so on is done by tides exerted in the outer parts of the accretion disk. But in these white dwarfs, you should remember that it can also, even if there's no accretion disk, because there isn't in the short period systems, it's direct impact, so there's no disk and no disk tides, but tides on the white dwarfs themselves can transfer the angular momentum back. So I'll just emphasize this little skeleton in the closet. So here's a picture I made of RxJ0806.3 plus 1527. This is the shortest period binary known in the galaxy, 5-minute orbital period. Two white dwarfs. One is about 2/100 of a solar mass dumping onto a half solar mass white dwarf. But this white dwarf is large enough that the stream doesn't form a disk. It just hits on the side of this white dwarf, and it was discovered in the X-rays as an X-ray pulsar. And the pulse is coming from the hot spot where this stream of gas from the L1 point hits the surface. The stream is optically thick, so there are no emission lines from the gas stream, no accretion disk at all. And so you would expect that this system, if there weren't any tides from the white dwarf, should be one of these cases where there's no transfer of angular momentum. And there are a number of things that are embarrassing about this system from the conventional point of view. You can calculate how fast the orbit should be shrinking by gravitational radiation. And if it's transferring mass and angular momentum is being conserved, then the system should be backing out. Well, the magnitude is right, but the sign is wrong in the X-rays. The system is indeed shrinking as if it were two masses that were not transferring mass, but we can see it transferring mass. It was discovered in the X-rays, right? Now, it's maybe not so bad because, well, the X-ray luminosity is actually several orders of magnitude lower than it should be in the standard theory. So maybe the system is in fact not transferring all that mass, so it could be expanding out. But then the question is, how did the system get to such a low mass if it weren't transferring mass? 0.02 solar mass white dwarfs must have got put their mass somewhere. And so maybe it's oscillating. It goes through stages of low transfer rate when it shrinks in, and then it goes to a high transfer rate and goes out, and maybe it oscillates. But it's been pretty stable for 15 years, so the time scale of oscillation must be very long. So I'm telling you a nice story, but you should remember there are perhaps a few things we don't understand yet. And there's another one of these with a 10-minute orbital period, which also is doing everything wrong. So it's not just this one. Okay, simulations. So the original simulations of what happens when these white dwarfs actually get together and begin coming into contact and transferring mass were done with smooth particle hydrodynamic simulations. And the results of those simulations was that everything disrupted. All the white dwarfs merged in a few orbits and made a disk around themselves. Even things with mass ratio of 0.5 and 0.3, which by theoretical prejudice you might expect shouldn't have done it. Recently, there have been much more extremely accurate Eulerian hydrosimulations from Joel Tolin's group. And they are the first people who have successfully not disrupted a white dwarf. So with high mass ratio, they disrupt, as you might expect. But with mass ratio of 0.5, an exact reproduction of one that SPH disrupted, they find that it doesn't disrupt for 30 orbits. So that theory perhaps was vindicated in that case. Now you might ask about ejection of mass. Does this collision of the two white dwarfs lead to shock waves that blow lots of matter out? And the answer is no. Both of these approaches agree that negligible mass, less than measurable amounts, less than a few percent, is ejected. So here are some pictures. This top one is the first case when the white dwarfs didn't disrupt. They just keep going round and round and round. They are transferring mass in a direct impact stream, but there's no disruption. And this is the time sequence that disrupted. And maybe I'll skip the movie for now, but if you want to see, there's nice movies of this that you can watch. So Tree asked me to talk about the electromagnetic appearance. First I'll tell you the conventional wisdom. So when these disruption events occur, people who are trying to see whether these could be type 1a supernovae or events of precursors to novae, the universal assumption is that, well, nothing can accrete faster than the Eddington rate. So dm dt is 10 to the minus 5 solar masses a year times the radius of the white dwarf, 10 to the 9 centimeters. Eddington luminosity is 5 to the 4 solar luminosities, and I claim that's bolometric magnitude of minus 6, 3. So if you ask if you dump a few tenths of a solar mass worth of white dwarf and you accrete at this rate, it lasts for a few thousand years. And it should be stable or sort of weak flashing helium burning. So that's the standard story. This 10 to the minus 5 solar masses a year is important because it's higher. It's a high enough rate that type 1a supernova modelers say that it leads to an off-center ignition and therefore conversion to an oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf and a neutron star, rather than both starting nicely in the center and blowing up as a type 1a supernova. But I'll have a few remarks about the confidence in that claim a little bit later. This, unfortunately, is not bright enough and not long enough to be interesting for this conference. So there's some magnetic alternatives. Now, I should first point out that the accretion rates driven by viscosity, if you actually calculate the m dot, some sort of estimate of the magnetic viscosity in one of these disks, or you should dump all the material in a few hours, basically. And this is enormously supercritical in the accretion rate. And so there are a couple of possibilities. One is, of course, that you might drive an enormous wind, and since it's so optically thick, that wind could come out advecting lots of photons and give you a very super Eddington luminosity. Even if you want to accrete, if you put in a weak magnetic field, it's known that accretion disks are unstable to the photon bubble instability, which is basically a photon analog of convection. and the disk starts off uniform, but it breaks up into regions of very high density where photons are trapped and can't get in, and regions of very low density where the photons free stream out. And the luminosities can be 10 or 100 times Eddington quite easily from an inhomogeneous disk like that. Mass is driven out in the low density regions. And so it's sort of a simple model of this. I think it's not unreasonable to expect that you could easily get 100 times Eddington luminosity, so bolometric magnitude minus 11, which is just at the bottom of Shree's survey curve in a lifetime of about a year, which is just on the edge of the cadence. So you can just about squeeze these in. So before I get on to the more spectacular magnetic alternatives, let me talk about the aftermath, which will introduce these. So what happens after the merger? These mergers have been proposed and probably do produce some, but maybe not all, single subdwarf OB stars, R core Bohr stars. There's this amazing, highly magnetic 1.35 solar mass white dwarf. There have been some suggestions that they produce most single white dwarfs above 0.7 solar masses. That may not be true, but they probably must produce some of them. And then they'll produce an accretion-induced collapse neutron stars, which might either be single millisecond pulsars or magnetars and AXPs. And they might produce type 1a supernovae, so lots of transient things. Okay. SDB stars and SDO stars are extreme horizontal branch stars, about half the solar mass, is less than a hundredth of the solar mass of hydrogen envelope. So they're just basically burning their helium and they'll just turn smoothly into white dwarfs on the white dwarf cooling sequence. And you can arrange to produce quite a lot of these from mergers. There are other channels of having a final helium flash just after the planetary nebula stage and so on. And you can also make these. I'll just point out one particularly interesting case. There are three hypervelocity stars known in the Milky Way with velocities above 700 kilometers a second beyond the solar circle, and one of them is an SDO star, which is moving at 750 kilometers a second. It's 14 kiloparsecs above the galactic plane, tearing out at 750 kilometers a second. And if you trace its orbit back, it goes, to the best you can determine, through the galactic center. And so there's a proposal that, in fact, it was ejected. It was produced in a three-body encounter with a supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy that produced this, merged the two white dwarfs and sent it sailing out 32 mega-years ago. R-core Bohr stars are these cool helium stars, about 10 to the 4 solar luminosities, with a hydrogen to helium less than 10 to the minus 4 solar. And they have these transient fadings due to dust formation in the wind. Once again, they're final helium flash models and CO plus helium white dwarf merger models. And there are serious proponents about both of these being the dominant mechanism, but I think all you could say is that this produces a rate that is consistent with it, but they might only be half or a quarter or something, or they might be three quarters of the total. Let me say a little bit, because this is, introduces the next topic. UV J0317 minus 85.5 is white dwarf log G is 9.3, so 1.35 solar masses. Has a rotation period of 700 seconds, so it's very rapidly rotating for a white dwarf. Has a magnetic field of 8 by 10 to the 8th Gauss. 10% circular polarization that varies on this rotation period, and the fitting of the lines. This is two different orbital phases, and you can see the magnetic field in one is 150 megagauss, and when the pole is pointing at you, it's 450 megagauss. Interestingly enough, it's in a wide binary. It has a companion star 200 AU away, which is a cooler, less massive, non-magnetic white dwarf. And it's very hard to make a white dwarf which is both rapidly rotating and this massive and this magnetic without doing it by merging two white dwarfs. So one interesting question is, if this had had only 0.05 of a solar mass more, what would have happened? And let me skip this one. So if it had had 0.05 of a solar mass more, then let's see, that's the next one. We would have compressed the magnetic field from 5 10 to the 8th Gauss by the ratio of white dwarf to neutron star up and got 10 to the 14 Gauss, if it had just happened to make a neutron star instead of a white dwarf. And so that suggests that perhaps some, at least CO plus CO white dwarf mergers actually make magnetars. And if they make magnetars, then they can make giant SGR flares, which could be a component of short gamma ray bursts. And so that was proposed by King et al., and more recently by Levon et al. In these papers. And even in about 10% of the heavy white dwarfs are magnetic, and so that gives you a rate that's actually roughly consistent with the inferred magnetar birth rate in the galaxy. Usov already in 1992, even before everybody accepted they were cosmological, proposed exactly this as a model for gamma ray bursts, that you merge two magnetic white dwarfs and they would undergo AIC and make it a highly magnetized white dwarf that would produce gamma ray bursts. Middleditch is even more ambitious. He wants not only to produce long GRBs, but also type 1bc and 2p supernovae out of this. It was two millisecond pulsars in supernova 1987A. Some of you may understand that. And I'll just mention that you could also wind up the magnetic field in the disk rather than just making the magnetar. You have an accretion disk around, which can wind up the magnetic field very rapidly, getting an even stronger B in jet expulsion. And so this would be basically a white dwarf analog of something that's been proposed in neutron stars by Dai et al. And Hink Sprout and so on. Okay. Okay.
So is it possible to get to concluding slide?
Yeah. So let's see. Well, the concluding slide is very short, so we can. There's a concluding slide. So I'll let you read that, and maybe I'll put on the one I didn't get to here. And stop.
These white dwarf systems, the five-layer binary system. Mm-hmm. They are very interesting systems. But here's the following part that comes to mind. What may be going on is that you have got, for instance, a transfer of mass with a companion, and it's probably tightly locked. I mean, these are tightly locked systems, I'm assuming. I mean, separation is so small that the tidal spin.
That would be the natural assumption, yes. Except for the sign of the m dot p dot.
Yeah, so I guess you have gone through this thing and you're saying that the magnitude is right. Meaning?
No, the orbital p dot is exactly what you would expect if they were non-interacting point masses. But the fact that they're accreting and tidally locked predicts that the orbit should be expanding,
right.
But it's contracting. That's exactly
what I've seen this before from pulsars, from famous pulsar system, but let's go on and set up.
Another question. We'd be mentioning at the end how a couple theorists had proposed this merger as gamma ray burst, as well as supernovae of all this type. Are there anywhere near enough of these systems to be producing all of these
things? Yeah. No, the rates are fine. Rates are perfectly fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the point. You can explain the gamma ray bursts with 10% of these, so and that's about the magnetic white dwarf fraction. So, I'm not saying it's necessarily true, but there's at least there's nothing obviously wrong like the rates with it. Remember, these are white dwarfs, so there are a lot more of these than there are neutron stars. So anything you can do with a neutron star is much easier with the white dwarfs.
So the orbital periods are increasing.
Which things?
Well,
it should be increasing. It isn't.
So back on the rate thing. The rates are not good for everything that Middleditch wants to explain with them. Is he just doing a fraction of the?
Well, I think you can just about get the 1bc's. I'm not. I don't know about how many 2p's there are that I haven't. I just mentioned Middleditch. I think that his proposal seemed a little harder than the other ones. But I think one should bear in mind that, I mean, I think one issue that's always sort of worried me is people assume that AIC is very different than ordinary supernovae. It just very quietly produces a neutron star with no ejection of matter, no high velocity kicks, nothing. But it is a supernova, and there could be substantial infall. So if you have evidence for underluminous supernovae with very little mass around them, it's probably worth thinking a little bit about that channel.
Yeah,
So can you discuss a little bit on, you know, the mergers of white box in terms of host galaxy types? For example, you know, nucleus galaxies and spiral galaxies, the rate and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think basically the rate should be weighted a little bit more towards the early type galaxies and the supernova rate. As I said, they're basically two channels. The systems that are formed with fairly short orbital periods basically track the star formation rate, so they'll look like supernovae and UV emission and H-alpha and so on, other tracers of star formation. But then there's also the long delay channel, which will basically just trace the total mass. So you can sort of understand the rates if you sort of divide up the galaxies and with one half of it tracing the mass or infrared light and the other half tracing the star formation. It's sort of a rough description of how you'd expect it to scale.
So still, can you explain the what is the basic physics? I'm trying to understand. So if, once I have a white dwarf merger, what sets the rate of energy release? Is just the viscosity timescale?
Oh, no. I think, well, so if you remember the picture, right, the...
This,
you get from there to there in, let's see, 4 minutes.
Okay, then why can't I drive a really high wind?
That was one of the choices I mentioned. The standard supernova 1A, the Moto type, says that all this stuff, which got put there in 5 minutes, sits there for 10 to the 5th years, accreting at 10 to the minus 5 solar masses a year at the Eddington rate.
Why?
Because I don't know why. Because then you can't make type 1A supernovae this way. But I think there are two possibilities. One is you could make it into a disk, which is then a fairly massive disk, and then accrete it, but probably at a somewhat super Eddington rate with a fairly substantial wind, or you could even have a fairly prompt, extremely super Eddington wind. It's perfectly possible.
The duration seems entirely unknown, all the way from a supernova, which is essentially instantaneous, to Eddington rate, which is...
Yeah, so that's what I was trying to say here.
So I'm saying, I can even have like 1 month.
Yeah, so the photon bubble instability, I think it's hard to get it more than 100 Eddington. So this is with a fairly small wind. But if you have a way of driving a really powerful...
I'm going to have some asymmetry. Here you're using some little things. It goes this way, but doesn't go this way.
If you have a stable disk, I think this is probably the right answer. But if you have some magnetic field or some other way of making a big sort of jet, putting power in a funnel or winding up magnetic fields, I think you could lose it in an hour,
so
probably.
So the signature between these two would be, in one case, photon bubble, I would expect to see essentially a spherical wind. And in the other case, I've had...
No, it would be a bipolar. I think it would be a bipolar wind.
Well,
there's
a disk. What's the angle, then? I don't understand. Where's the angle set by?
Oh, no, it's a fairly wide wind. I mean, I don't know. It depends if it's magnetic. But it's a radiation-driven wind from the disk, from the top and the bottom of the disk. So it won't be spherical, but I don't know how collimated it will be.
Isn't it sense that the Nomoto just assumes you have the lower mass wide dwarf and you have the angular momentum
loss
by gravitational radiation just drives them that rate that you have to.
No. Well, the type 1A supernova calculations is this disrupt. I mean, it's unstable. It's generally disruption if you have comparable mass CO white dwarfs. So you basically you merge the two white dwarf cores, and then the outer parts of them are a disk that accretes, and it's that which is being done. I mean, this is in the double degenerate scenario for the type 1A supernova. For the ultra soft sources, then it's stable accretion.
But I saw Nomoto with the two white dwarfs, but if you get them to burn so slowly for about 1,000 years and then they convert into a neutron star instead of blowing up, isn't that due to the fact that the merger is rather slow?
The merger is dynamical time. It's just there's a bunch of material left outside and there's a disk, and he assumes that the disk is Eddington limited. And here, so the So the question is really what happens once the white dwarf is maximally rotating. The question is what happens in the boundary layer interaction between the white dwarf and the disk. And Pierce-Sondy et al. Assumed that it stopped accreting and or slowed down the accretion, so they got the accretion rate below the critical value, and so they got type 1a supernovae. And then Sayo and Nomoto said, oh, but Narayan and Popham said that it can keep accreting, and so he just assumed the accretion rate was constant. And of course, then he got AIC again, but you know, this is spherical calculation, there's no self-consistent boundary layer, so I think we don't know yet.
Let's thank Mr. again. And it's been with us about